Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you and we are all in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and check out the Commonwealth Club YouTube channel. I'm Jeanette Shaw, CEO of Techology, and your moderator for tonight's program, Autonomous Vehicles and the Future of Transport. I've been in technology for over 30 years. Techology provides public policy knowledge, government relations advocacy, and stakeholder engagement to meet the needs of the innovative technology sector, such as autonomous vehicles. Prior to Techology, I worked for a Fortune 500 semiconductor company and was chosen by the VC firm Kleiner Perkins to establish TechNet, otherwise known as Technology Network, a national tech-focused public policy organization. This evening, I am going to be honored to introduce such a wonderful panel. And once I introduce the panel, we're going to go ahead and review the definition of what an autonomous vehicle is. So we'll set the stage. And then each panelist will have 3 to 5 minutes to talk about their vision and what the landscape looks to them for autonomous vehicles. Following the panelist openings, we'll then have Q&A, and that will include audience questions that you'll have written on the cards and will be passed up. So with that, I'd like to start with and introduce Emily Castor. Emily is the Director of Transportation Policy at Lyft. Emily has been on the forefront of ride-sharing policy since the birth of the industry. That's a long time.
It's actually not that long. That's what's so scary.
And dog years, maybe. She leads Lyft's work with transportation agencies to integrate shared mobility and measure its impacts. Emily believes Lyft is a critical tool to expand transportation access, reduce car ownership, and cut carbon emissions. Emily is an advisory board member at the Institute of Transportation Studies at UCLA, on the Sharing Economy Advisory Network, and on the Leadership Council of the National Center for Sustainable Transportation, among many other board positions. I also had the opportunity to get to ask each board member panelist about a fun fact about them. And Emily's fun fact is that she has a hidden talent for saying the alphabet backwards very, very fast. We may need to have you do that at the end of this program.
After party.
There we go. She's also addicted to ice cream and can recommend at least 5 can't-miss ice cream shops here in San Francisco. I think I have a few here. Ice Cream Bar, Mitchell's, Mr. and Mrs. Miscellaneous, By Right, and Smitten. So maybe we can all take an autonomous vehicle out to go for ice cream.
Or at least a Lyft.
Or at least a Lyft. Exactly. Our next panelist is Claire Dolani. She is the co-founder and director of software engineering at Otto, which was recently purchased by Uber. Claire brings 12 years of experience in robotics to the Otto team. After graduating from EPSI in France with an MS in computer engineering, Claire worked on autonomous cars and robotics for Intempora, Stanford Research Institute, and Goste. She is a founder of several robotics companies, including Nextra Robotics, Robotics Valley, and Corebots. Most recently, Claire worked as a staff software engineer for Google, where she led several innovative robotic projects. I can only imagine what those were like. It would be fun to have been a fly on the wall. And also, fun fact about Claire. When she was younger, she was choosing between pursuing veterinary sciences and computer science. And despite her love of nature, she actually ultimately chose computer science. And thankfully, because we have a robotics project today. So welcome.
Thank you.
Our next panelist, it's no stranger to the autonomous vehicle world, is Lauren Isaac. Mm-hmm. Lauren is the manager of sustainable transportation at WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff, a professional services and transportation consulting firm. She is involved in advanced technology projects that can improve mobility in many cities. In 2015, she was awarded the firm's William Barclay Parsons Fellowship for developing a guide titled Driving Toward Driverless, a guide for government agencies regarding how local and regional governments should respond to autonomous vehicles in the short, medium, and in the long term. In addition, Lauren maintains the blog Driving towards driverless. That's got to be a full-time job. And has presented on this topic at more than 30 industry conferences. She recently did a TEDx talk and has been published in Forbes, New York Times, and the Chicago Tribune, among other publications. Lauren has a Master of Engineering degree in Operations, Research, Industrial Engineering, and a bachelor's degree in the same discipline from Cornell University. So we've placed our two engineers in the yes. center of our panel. And the fun fact about Lauren is, well, Lauren, congratulations, just got married a few weeks ago. And she was on a mission to get a driverless vehicle at her wedding. Emily was recently engaged. Emily, I think you're going to have to do the same. At least you'll get there by Lyft. And despite having multiple companies and people in the industry working hard to make it happen, it seems she might have been just a little early. So a couple of the companies, though, thankfully, have promised her a driverless vehicle at her one-year anniversary celebration. And then our final panelist introduction is Lindsay Willis. Lindsay is the Director of External Affairs at Contra Costa Transportation Authority. Lindsay is responsible for directing communication, advocacy, and community engagement efforts. Her leadership has produced award-winning public engagement, programs, and international recognition for the authority's innovative utilization of technology. And if you haven't been on Costa County Transportation Authority's website, I highly recommend you go, because the technology is just amazing that Lindsay has put together. Lindsay's been responsible for increasing brand awareness for all of the $1.3 billion in local transportation projects and programs. And this includes establishing the brand and directing the launch of Go Momentum Station in Concord, California, the nation's largest secured connected vehicle and autonomous vehicle test bed. Which is just got to be
full.
It's got to be an amazing place just to sit and watch. Some people watch airplanes. I think you could just watch autonomous vehicles go by. And then prior to joining the authority in 2013, Lindsay spent 9 years leading marketing and communication initiatives and developing strategic partnerships for the Capital Corridor Joint Powers Authority. Fun fact about Lindsay, Lindsay's first introduction to transportation, other than sharing the back seat of a station wagon with her three sisters, had to have been exciting, was a train trip from California to Vancouver for the 1986 World Fair. Many years later, her first job in transportation was with the Capital Corridor Train Service, which is here in California. So that is our panelists. So at this time, it's like, okay, so what is an autonomous vehicle? It has other names too, such as driverless vehicle, self-driving vehicle, highly automated vehicle, which was a new term we recently have seen from the federal government, or robotic car. Do you think of Johnny Cab and Total Recall featuring our former governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, when you hear autonomous vehicle? That sometimes comes to my mind. So just what is it? An autonomous car is a vehicle that is capable of sensing its environment and navigating without human interaction. Autonomous cars can detect their surroundings using a variety of techniques such as radar, sensors, and communication networks. So now I'd like to go down the line, starting with Emily, and just if you could start and just paint a picture of how you would define AVs and what you see the future of autonomous vehicles looking like.
Sure. Well, I'm really excited to be here and share a little bit about Lyft's vision for autonomous vehicles. And I think it's easy to imagine an entry point into that because ride sharing has already started to lay the groundwork for what that will look like, this transition in mobility behavior that we're starting to see coming down in the next few years with autonomous. If you think about it, it's really the beginning of a major transition away from the relationship with vehicles being one of ownership toward a relationship of transportation as a service. So Lyft has taught people to have that kind of relationship over the last few years as we've rolled out on-demand mobility through a digital interface, given people the ability to tap a button, have a driver show up. And if you think about it, there's not such a huge difference between that behavior and the behavior of tapping a button on your phone and having an autonomous vehicle show up. You're not driving it. You're not owning it. You're accessing that when you need it and only when you need it. So we're
we're excited about the fact that the network that we've built has laid the groundwork for what can later be layered on top as autonomous technology becomes available. And our founder, John Zimmer, spoke recently and published his thoughts recently about what we see as this coming third transportation revolution. First transportation revolution that our country experienced was the development of trains and canals that facilitated interstate commerce and led to the development of big cities. Then, of course, the second transportation revolution is the one that we're all living in now and have grown up in, of the automobile. Interstate highways that cut up our cities and really changed the relationship of people to the urban environment in what many might say was a negative way. What we're experiencing now and really on the cusp of is an opportunity to reclaim the urban vitality that we've lost, to restructure our environment so that it's no longer centered around car ownership and instead can take that space, devote it to new, more productive uses. If you think about the parklets that proliferate on the city of San Francisco's streets here, which are so wonderful in restoring common spaces, that is just a small taste of what we expect we will be able to enjoy as cities, as you know, urban dwellers in the future, as the need for parking is eliminated, the need for car ownership is eliminated, and we can reclaim that urban space, use it to build housing, use it to build green space. And this is something that can be accomplished through leveraging autonomous technology in new ways. How will this first come into the market? We think it'll be a new mode that becomes available on top of Lyft's existing platform so that it's not an abrupt transition for our users. Instead, it can be gradual. In environments where this is something that we believe we can test successfully in the early deployments, there may be corridors, fixed routes, or fixed zones that have been extensively mapped and monitored for the quality and the capability of the infrastructure in those locations to make sure they're appropriate for autonomous vehicle operation in the beginning and to generate consumer acceptance and familiarity, and then gradually expanded broadly, you know, obviously to the point where ultimately it will be available anywhere, and do so in the way that you might associate with what you experienced with wireless networks coming online, where first, you know, you had that kind of slow edge data connection, and then over time when 3G and later 4G became available, it just dropped onto your phone. You didn't have to go out and buy new technology. Those networks are something that you could automatically tap into, and this is something that we're really excited to see and see the potential, frankly, of democratizing access to our platform happen very quickly as the cost of getting a Lyft ride comes down very significantly with the rise of autonomy. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Terrific.
All right. So why don't I start talking about truck instead of cars? So what is an autonomous truck? Well, an autonomous truck would be is basically like the old truck that we all know with like a lot of sensor able to perceive the environment much better than a human would do. Just because we see with laser, we see with radars, we see with cameras, we see where the truck is in the world with GPS. And with all this information, the truck gets a very like in-depth knowledge to where it is and what is like the surrounding environment. So how does it relate to, like, that's exactly the same thing that we put actually in the cars. This is why Uber decided to acquire Otto, to transfer this technology and to basically, same like as Emily mentioned, go and push the AV space forward. So there's a lot of potential with AV, and like the definition of autonomous vehicle is not necessarily like the car that we can imagine with like without a driver that doesn't like take the road and like go ahead. So we already started. There's a current car that we own. We already have like autonomous technologies. We call them ADAS or like aid assistance to driving. But we actually already like accumulating little by little bricks, component technological bricks that are essential to make a vehicle fully autonomous. So it's like a gradual process. This is going to take time. And like Emily said, there's a lot of like things that have to evolve around the vehicle. Like when you think about the world was designed for humans. Everything that we see was designed for humans, like the stop signs, the lights, the pedestrian, like walkway. Everything was designed for a human to interpret the environment. But moving forward, if we really want to make like autonomous vehicle like a commodity and like very mass market autonomous vehicles, we will have also to change gradually the infrastructure and to adapt it to make it more machine friendly, I would say, so that the robot can understand their environment easier. So that would be the technical of the technicality of the AV. Emily already like talked a lot about social impacts, and I will let the panelists like give their point of view about AV.
Okay, thank you. So I come at this from a different angle. I work at WSP Parsons Brinckerhoff, where a piece of what we do is consulting for government agencies on advising them on transportation and infrastructure projects. So I've been in this space for my whole career, and about 2.5 years ago, I started reading about driverless vehicles, and what was very clear at the time was that the technology was advancing very, very quickly, but our clients, the government agencies, were really at that time not very aware of that technology. And if you look at the headlines from back then, it was all about, you know, who's putting the most test miles on the road and what technology's out there, which companies are getting involved, but almost nothing about what the government is doing. So about that time is when I started my research about what government can do to plan for driverless vehicles. And I'm happy to say that fast forward to where we are today, federal government has been really involved. Jeanette just alluded to the federal policy. I've been really interested and focused on what the local and state governments can do, partially because we're seeing this technology out on the streets now, and yet if you look at most of our government agencies' long, short and long-range plans, which go anywhere from 5-year plans to 40 and 50-year plans, over 90% of them don't acknowledge that driverless vehicles are coming. So when you think about that, when you think about the impact that they can have on society, both positive and negative, there are a lot of impacts that are going to be really symbiotic with government's goals, improved safety, better mobility for our different populations like elderly and disabled people. But there are also some risks, and I think it's really important that government agencies start to become aware of what these are. So for example, if we have a society where Lyft and Uber don't end up with these shared fleets and other automakers who are investing in doing more shared fleets, but if we see a society very similar to what we have today with a lot of vehicle ownership, single occupancy vehicle trips, and then with what driverless vehicles present, which is zero occupancy trips being allowed, we have a risk of a huge increase in vehicle miles traveled. And I will just say I'm one of the biggest fans of driverless vehicles, and I can't wait to see them really proliferate in society. But I think government has a very important role to play in terms of managing the benefits, making sure we reap the benefits of them, but also mitigate the risks.
So when I first met Lauren, her question to me was, why is a county government agency involved in driverless vehicles? What do you guys have to do with this? So I wanted to give you a little background for those of you that don't know who the Contra Costa Transportation Authority is. We're maybe not quite as famous as some of these other companies that I'm sharing the stage with tonight. In 1988, voters in Contra Costa chose to tax themselves with a sales tax to pay for transportation, and our agency is the agency that plans, funds, and delivers those transportation improvements that the voters voted for. And in California, there are actually 20 counties that tax themselves through sales tax to help pay for transportation. The Bay Area is full of them. San Francisco is one of them, and they play a really critical part in keeping California moving. They invest about $3 to $4 billion a year into California's transportation system and infrastructure. And so how that kind of rolls out, you know, fast forward to 2004, that 1988 measure was about to expire, and we went back out to voters to ask them to, again, decide to renew that sales tax for another 25 years. And you may be able to get people to choose to tax themselves once, but if you're not delivering on their promises, they're definitely not going to give you another chance to do that. And I'm proud to say that 71% of voters in Contra Costa chose to continue that sales tax to continue to fund transportation improvements. So our job is to make those happen, and in addition to making those improvements happen, part of our responsibilities involve being the congestion management agency for the county, so we're in charge of finding ways to try to mitigate traffic, and we're also the long-range transportation planning agency for the county. So you can see how with a staff of only 20 people, we're pretty busy. But those last two responsibilities really kind of led to our interest in autonomous vehicles. As Lauren mentioned,
not many agencies kind of look forward as they develop their long-range plan. The tendency is to take today's technology and embed it into a plan for the next 25 years. Well, if you think about the fact that the iPhone is less than 10 years old and how much that has revolutionized how we work, how we travel, how we communicate, it seemed really foolish to us to just assume that technology was going to remain static. It's changing so quickly. So we decided that we really needed to pay close attention to what was happening in the technology and transportation space so that as we build our long-range plans for the county, we can really be prepared and responsive to the new technology that's coming online instead of just being reactive. So as part of that effort, we helped co-found Gomentum Station in Concord, California, which, as Jeanette said, is the largest secure, autonomous, and connected vehicle test facility. And it's really a partnership where auto manufacturers can come and test their vehicles and test their technologies in a secure location that's not a city street, test out technology upgrades. Because it's a former Navy weapons station, it has a mini city. It has striping, stop signs, sidewalks, tunnels, buildings. So it's a really great place to kind of reenact scenarios that take place in the real world in a really unique setting. And what it does for us as a government agency is it gives us the ability to talk with the folks who are testing, see what they're testing, look at the technology, and figure out what does it need, what do we need to be looking at to upgrade our infrastructure over the coming years to make sure that those cars can operate, you know, optimally and safely and help get you where you need to go.
Terrific. Well, that is an excellent set the stage for the viewpoints. And I know we've talked a lot about autonomous cars and autonomous trucks, so we'll make sure autonomous vehicles, we can be inclusive. But why don't we talk about what are the benefits? And then I'd like to actually ask, what kind of negative aspects are there and what do we mitigate? But Lauren, if you could start with, what are the benefits to, let's say, a community, to a city for autonomous vehicles?
There are quite a few. The biggest one, and certainly from a government perspective, the interests are around safety, but this is really what all the automakers and technology developers cite first and foremost. So today, 90% of the accidents that happen on our roadways are due to human error. So distracted driving, drunk driving, speeding. So in theory, if we eliminate the humans from the driving equation, we will eliminate over 90% of the accidents. So that in itself is huge. I mentioned before additional mobility for elderly, disabled, youth. That piece is really exciting. Another one is a rethinking of our land use. So driverless vehicles will create the potential for either reducing the parking requirements needed or even relocating them. So if we have more of a shared use society where people aren't purchasing as many vehicles but that they are sharing them, we potentially can reduce the land's use dedicated for parking. And in cities, that can be around 15 to 20% of the land. So try to reimagine San Francisco streets without that dedicated land. I mean, it's really, you can see how the potential for adding bike lanes, adding more pedestrian space. I mean, that's my utopian perspective. But and the other side of it is even if we have this more of my nightmare perspective of more people owning vehicles, it still could result in relocating parking spaces where these vehicles could bring people to their work in the morning, say, and then the vehicle goes and parks itself in a remote parking lot 15 miles outside of a city, which is amazing from a land use perspective, but terrible from a congestion, travel time reliability perspective. So another piece is the ability to have improved acceleration and deceleration, so less impact to our roadways. Vehicles, in theory, will be able to drive more closely together, especially if it integrates with connected technology. There's a slew more, but hopefully that gives a flavor.
That certainly does. And what about if, Emily, would you like to take a stab at maybe what are some of the negative, some of the aspects where it may not be as positive and areas where technology can improve that?
Yeah, I mean, I think really if you talk to a lot of the experts right now, people are saying that the fulcrum is whether or not these are shared vehicles or owned vehicles. You know, I think Lauren pointed to that very correctly, which is, you know, if you think about it, most of the ills of private auto ownership and frankly of, you know, the unsustainable transportation system and its land use impacts that we have today arise from the fact that vehicles are so poorly utilized. They're sitting idle 94% of the time. They're only 20% occupied when they're in motion on average. So that's a lot of empty vehicle seats, and it's a very underutilized asset that we're paying to store and using precious land to store. And then you think about sort of how that then telegraphs into an autonomous vehicle world. It's probably something that is magnified. Whether you go the ownership route and everybody owns their own autonomous vehicle, it magnifies the negative impacts in many ways. Maybe not with respect to parking, but certainly with respect to vehicle miles traveled, emissions, underutilization of vehicles would be magnified if everyone owned their own. Whereas if you look on the shared side of the equation, there are very significant reductions that are possible. Actually, fascinating research from a couple of different research groups recently looking at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. A guy there named Jeff Greenblatt put out a simulation study finding that shared electric autonomous vehicles used in a platform that dispatches them on demand, like Lyft does, could actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions by over 90%. And if all of the vehicles adopted electric powertrains, as certainly we expect those on our platform will benefit from, that could actually eliminate petroleum consumption 100% in our transportation system. These may sound like Pollyanna kinds of unbelievable expectations. I mean, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab is certainly not a lightweight, but there was another report that just came out with very similar conclusions from the Rocky Mountain Institute, a very well-regarded energy think tank that found enormous possibility for reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, as well as reduction of costs in the expenditure of operating vehicles. So frankly, I think there's a really good economic argument for why it will happen that way, and why we should believe the fact that urban car ownership's days are numbered. Because if you think about an individual making a decision about how they want to get around on a monthly basis, if they're comparing in their household budget the costs of owning a car with that lease, with that car payment, you know, or their insurance costs, parking perhaps in an urban environment, and then comparing it to a greatly reduced cost of transportation as a service, walking, biking, on-demand, autonomous electric, Lyft rides, transit combined together, that package on the shared side is going to be much, much cheaper than what the cost of car ownership is today. It'll be a much more dramatic difference than that equation looks like today, and I think that's what will precipitate a shift away from car ownership and along with it bring the benefits rather than the potential negatives into the public realm.
I just want to add one quick thing because I totally agree. I think it's really important to point out the distinction between autonomous technology and electric technology. Mm-hmm. They're entirely separate. And so the benefits, if we go entirely electric for autonomous, are huge. However, not all of the auto manufacturers that are developing this technology are testing driverless with electric. So it's not an assumed thing. I think it's wonderful that Lyft is.
I think the majority of them are, though, which is actually a really interesting
promising thing.
And I think I just want to comment briefly on why that might be the case.
Yeah.
Maybe people haven't thought about sort of financially why that would be the case. But the cost of operation of vehicles over the life of that car is much lower with electric vehicles, at least at the current costs of electricity versus petroleum, than the cost of operating those vehicles as combustion engine vehicles. So it makes financial sense as long as operationally there's sufficient access to charging infrastructure, which is absolutely something that our policymakers should be paying attention to. There is actually a strong business case for vehicle electrification, especially with the new battery technology that's advancing so quickly with vehicles like the Bolt coming online soon.
Absolutely. That was one of our audience questions as well, is about the impact of the electric grid and just what would the future look like. And Claire, I wanted to give you an opportunity just to talk about the benefits for trucks.
Benefits of AV?
Of AV.
So right now in the U.S. we have a shortage of drivers just because it's a very painful job. And it's like you have to be alone on the road for long hours and for a very long time, extended period of time. And one benefit of autonomous technology is that basically you Like, I mean, I would say, like, I'm not going to, suddenly jump into the future where we don't have a driver, because that's not going to happen, like, from just tomorrow. That's going to be gradual. So the first step is going to be, like we see in the plane, you know? Like, the pilot is here to do, like, the landing and the takeoff. But during the flight, the plane is driving autonomously. So the pilot can do other stuff and, like, basically have, like, this time to do something else. Same thing for applies for trucking. When you look at the highway and you'll see, like, all the cars going by, it look like, you know, a train or, like, a railroad. And, like, the driver would, like, the truck driver would just, like, bring the truck to the entrance of the highway and let the truck operate from there and drive by itself until it reaches a destination. As a truck can do 2,000 miles autonomously, it basically means, like, the drivers have a lot of time to just, like, do something else in the meantime. Read a book, watch TV, like, learn something new, or drink a beer.
I like to get Lindsay.
it would force us to, like, the truck driver would become more guardians, or, like, than actively having to have the hands on the wheel and just paying attention to, I mean, trying to keep focus for long hours without, like, anything changing in the landscape or anything that's happening. So that would be, like, that could have a tremendous impact, because that moment we release the driver, we can actually, like, I mean, most of the fleet in the U.S. right now, which are owner operator, basically mean that these people could spend all this time in the truck to do something else. Also, file the tax, like, spend time with the family in, like, conference call. It could be, like, completely different. And long term, maybe I would say it's hard to, like, give an idea on, like, the timeline, but let's say, like, 5 to 7 years. Let's say that we worked very hard with the government and that the highway are very safe and equipped, and we can guarantee there is, like, 99.99999% of, like, non-defaults or non-problems, not any problems on this road. So highway would be very specific areas that are safe for AV. Well, in that case, it would probably mean that we don't have to, like, we don't have to get a driver in anymore in this particular area. We can just let the car go by itself, like the truck go by itself, and, like, ship a good to the next arrival. And then we will use Uber or Lyft driver in the end, like, to take the truck, like the merchandise, or, like, the truck out of the highway toward, like, a warehouse. And so what it would mean, one of the reasons why we have big trucks, it's because we don't have a lot of, like, drivers. And so we want to make sure that we put everything in, like, a single convoy so that, like, we minimize, like, the number of drivers. So the moment you don't have a driver anymore, it actually means that you get smaller trucks that are also less dangerous and even eventually more power efficient. Mm-hmm. That you can also rethink the logistics. So you don't have to put, like, a lot of things that are no common ground together in the same truck and, like, move it, like, along just because of the driver issue. You can be smart. You can replan differently how you transfer goods from one place to another one. And when you start digging around this efficiency, and you start by AV, but you, like, start pulling the thread and look at the logistics and all the chains and how goods are, like, transferred from one place to another one, you can see that the AV would have a tremendous impact on how efficient we will be in the future, how efficient good transportation can be in the future. And I think it even stands more than passenger, because passenger is always like, yeah, you know, you like driving your cars. Sure, you it's very convenient to have Uber or Lyft or, like, have someone like bringing you to one place to another one, but when you have a nice car, don't you like driving like on the highway and, like, when there is no traffic? It's still a pleasure, right? Transport of goods is another story, because, like, it actually it's linked everywhere into our economy. Like, everything that you see here was brought by a truck. Every single detail was brought at some point by a truck. So when you think that you can make this this part more efficient, the implications are tremendous. I sit in some of them, but you can come up with even more just by looking at the at how the goods are transported nowadays.
Yeah, and Lindsay, you were going
I was going to say, I think Claire stole most of my thunder, because I was going to say...
You were nodding quite a bit.
Right after, you know, safety, efficiency is something that transportation professionals really have to look at, and that's the efficiency of the whole system. That's not just passenger vehicles. That's how you move freight. That's how you move transit. And I think one of the big promises for autonomous vehicles is that you can move more things, more people, more cars, more goods through the existing system safely and faster. If you think about it, you know, if you've ever been stuck on I-80 or I-680 in bumper-to-bumper traffic, if your car could take over and drive itself autonomously, if it could follow a safe distance behind the car in front of it that's much closer than you might be able to follow as a human driver, you can get more cars through that stretch of freeway faster and smoother. And that's something that we're very interested in looking at. You know, the current, I think, highway capacity manual that Caltrans publishes says when you build a freeway in an urban area, it has to be able to take 2,400 cars per lane per hour. Think about how much more efficient that system would operate if you could bump that up by an extra 1,000 cars per lane per hour. You smooth out the entire system and make it much more efficient for everyone trying to get where they want to go.
Terrific. Well, at this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we are talking about autonomous vehicles and the future of transport. We have Emily Castor, Director of Transportation Policy at Lyft, Lindsay Willis, Director of External Affairs for Contra Costa Transportation Authority, Lauren Isaac, Manager of Transportation Sustainability at WSP, Parsons Brinckerhoff, and Claire Dulani, Co-Founder and Director of Software Engineering at Otto. Commonwealth Club programs are on the radio, and you can see our program videos on YouTube. Catch us also on our website, as well as Facebook and Twitter. We've got it all. Mm-hmm. I am Jeanette Morgan Shaw, CEO of Techology, and your moderator for today's program. With that, I'd like to, we've got a number of audience questions about jobs. And in particular, you may recall that James Hines, who's the Gartner Research Director, said connected vehicles will continue to generate new products and service innovations and create new companies. And it'll enable a new value proposition and business models. We hear that a lot. But we have several questions here about will drivers who drive for Lyft or other ride-sharing companies, will they still be able to drive? And what is the risk if this technology creates unemployment?
Yeah, this is a great question. This is something that we really approach really seriously at Lyft, because frankly, we've differentiated ourselves in the market as a company that cares more about our drivers and, you know, have invested in great relationships with our drivers because we believe it translates into the passenger experience, and that's at the core of what we offer. So we've wanted to be really transparent in the way that we talk about this transition and the fact that it's coming. I mean, at the end of the day, this is something that's coming to our society. Lyft cannot stop the arrival of this technology, and I think it's incumbent upon any entity that's working in the transportation business today, whether it's freight or public transit or private transport or automotive companies, to be the Netflix in this situation rather than the Blockbuster, right? We have to remain relevant and capable of making an impact with what we do, which we have to participate in this technology to do that. That being said, it's not going to be an abrupt and immediate transition away. Now, first of all, it's important to understand how people participate in Lyft driving. The vast majority of people who participate as drivers on our platform are doing it on a very part-time basis. 85% of them are doing it fewer than 15 hours per week. And for those folks, even those folks who are doing it on a more full-time basis, they aren't necessarily doing it for a long period of time. It's a rather transient population that are saying, hey, I had a job loss. I need extra income right now. I'm in a life transition. I'm seeking an opportunity for flexibility in my life right now. And that's exactly why they came to us in the first place, because Lyft driving is not structured with the rigidity and the permanence of a traditional job. So there's a lot of lead time for people to absorb this transition that's coming and to become aware of that and make plans for their future. However, we actually expect that in the near term, the demand for Lyft drivers will increase on our platform as automation rolls out. And that sounds really counterintuitive. But the reason why is because of what I described earlier, the fact that basically there's going to be an explosion in the market size of these businesses like ours that are offering the service, because all of a sudden, Lyft will become so much more affordable that people will be able to use it much more often. And they're going to look at that calculation of whether or not they want to own a car anymore, and more of them are going to start saying, no, we don't want to own a car, so we want to use Lyft a bunch more of the time than we were before. And as we do that, sometimes we're going to be able to get an automated Lyft because we'll be in a place where that's available. Other times, we're going to be taking a Lyft with a human driver. So that market size is going to grow in the near term. And then ultimately, yes, it will taper off as the technology becomes more capable, as it becomes available in a broader variety of geographical areas. And that's a transition that we'll be very transparent and compassionate about with our valued driver community.
I also know in the career that I live in quite a bit with career technical education, as well as science and technology, engineering, mathematics, and you can call that STEM, and then also STEAM, where you add art, there I've seen a huge increase in individuals who are being contacted by companies to go into learning how to do coding or software or engineering. So there's a whole host that we get contacted of companies. We're under NDAs to can't describe what the positions are, but there is a whole host of companies that are looking for new opportunities to train individuals for new jobs. But I'd like to pass it on to Lindsay.
Go first.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say, I think one of the places where we hear a lot of concern about the coming of automation is in the transit world. There are quite a few folks employed, your bus driver, your BART driver, the folks who help get you where you need to go, and they're worried about what the transition to driverless means for them. And I think one of the things we have to be cognizant of is, as we mentioned earlier, the state has some really ambitious climate goals. There are some things here in California that we're trying to achieve, and one of those is encouraging people to share vehicles, to start traveling together, to reduce greenhouse gases. And one of the things that we've been working really hard on is to encourage people to potentially use autonomous vehicles to get themselves to transit. These are great solutions for that first and last mile trip. How many times have you ever driven your car to try to park it at a BART station at 8:30 in the morning, and you're circling and circling and circling, and nobody's leaving, and there's no spot, and you end up driving to your ultimate destination? If you could get a shared ride, to that particular location, then maybe you would be more inclined to use public transit because it would take out the aggravation of trying to find parking. I think, too, when you think about autonomous vehicles and shared autonomous vehicles, these are going to be large fleets. They're going to need to be maintained. They're going to need to be monitored. Those are jobs that are still going to have to be done by someone, potentially with transit or transportation experience. So there may be some opportunity to kind of retrain some of the existing workforce to take on some of those new duties. But I do think that transit, kind of as we know it, is really going to benefit from autonomous vehicles. I think a lot of the first trips that you'll start to see are going to be short trips to and from transit stations or to and from schools or business centers. Those trips, you know, when you have to take your mother to the hairdresser and you don't want to drive her, you can just put her in a car and let her go do it herself. When you don't want to have that conversation about flipping the coin with your sister about who's going to drive grandma to the senior center, you have your solution. So I really think that's kind of, you're going to start to see those short trips happen first. Although I don't know, Claire might be giving us a run for our money with long-term free hauling. So.
I think it's really gonna be gradual. I really don't see happening like from the day to like from like just tomorrow. I know it's very exciting technology, but there's a lot of challenges that have to be solved, and a lot of things. I mean, like that's a very good reflection, like a very good mirror to the panel we have today. That autonomous vehicle, it's about a lot of things. It's about companies who are operating in the public space, or like companies in but not in the public space, and like with consumers. Mm-hmm. Auto was not Uber before, so we were targeting a very dedicated problem. And there's like government, more like problems, and there's like a lot of issues in the future that we need to plan and like think about. So that is like such a huge problem, and AV by itself touch a lot of like different aspects of like the way we live, like our life in cities and like cities to cities. So I think it's actually gonna for all these reasons to make it right and to make it the right way. It will take a lot of time, and I think it's a lot of opportunities for a lot of these people to also like slowly graduating, be trained, and to learn other area and like. All these jobs that are around AV and like how do we organize what it means to get like autonomous vehicles all the time would have to be created. We will still need places to like recharge the cars, or we will still need places to like to put the car at some point, like at the end of the day. We will still need public transportation because like if you still like have a 4-seat cars behind of another 4-seat cars and another 4-seat cars, then it's still gonna take much more space than a bus. Not that the bus cannot be autonomous also, but still we have like a fleet of things that have to be coordinated together. It seems very threatening for the stages right now, but most of the time when things evolve slowly, it's not the same. It's like we don't have a fracture suddenly, or where suddenly like full job category disappears. Things happen slowly and gradually, and like people find other areas of interest. And just because like I mean, if a car drives better than me, at some point I'm gonna be bored anyway. Even if I could board to drive it, but like it's not very fun. Like remember like the market. Stock market, we have like at the beginning was super exciting to be like to sell and like stock and everything and to be like a trader and like to be at the state of the technology and everything. But then slowly, gradually, artificial intelligence takes a step on it and like algorithm become like more efficient than people. And so at some point, if like when you compare like the result of an algorithm and yourself and you see that an algorithm is a better trader than you, then it like totally removes the fun out of it. Because you cannot compete with an algorithm. It's like it doesn't care anyway. So
I'll add one thing, because it's a little bit different lens on sort of the equity impact piece. I think the labor question is not the only equity question. And another one is about mobility access. And that's actually what I think is one of the most exciting benefits that can come from this. But it definitely is also hinging on shared versus owned as being the model of how this rolls out. But frankly, I mean, transportation is a huge economic barrier right now in our country, especially with the reurbanization that we've seen in major cities, the cost of housing in major cities going up so precipitously. There's been a suburbanization of poverty that has happened. It has pushed people out to the areas that have been least well served by transit and given them a huge transportation problem for the most vulnerable populations. And so now people have these super commutes where they're trying to piece together bus routes in, frankly, areas where it's not efficient to operate buses, where point-to-point transportation saves people hours in travel time per day. And yet these are families who can't necessarily own the $9,000 per year cost of owning a car. I mean, I'm passionate about the fact that shared autonomous transportation can actually be affordable enough that it can be something that's accessible for those folks, and actually, you know, making it possible for more people to benefit from this technology who wouldn't necessarily be able to buy an autonomous car, right? And I mean, there are all kinds of technological pathways that can be established to make this available even when people don't have bank accounts, when they don't have smartphones. I mean, these are things we're already working on with Lyft in our public-private partnerships. So there's, you know, there's sort of this elite lens at which we can look at all of this in terms of technological advancement, but there's also a real impact on people's lives and problems that we can solve.
Absolutely, and the equity lens is an excellent opportunity to discuss that. And Lauren, you look like you were...
I always have something to say about it.
I think that's an excellent point that Emily raised, too, because it really is from a leader's lens, and there is an opportunity for shared mobility that will impact equity.
Yeah. You want me to go back to the jobs question?
Certainly. That's where your head was nodding and bobbing.
I was agreeing with everything everybody said. I mean, I completely agree this is not going to happen overnight. that point has been made. And while I also agree that there will be job loss that comes from this technology, as is what happens with any disruptive technology, we've seen it with countless industries already, at the same time, there are going to be job opportunities created. And I think through things like STEM, like you were talking about, getting more of the younger generation that are going through college, getting them educated in the right fields. So things like data science, that is such a rich field right now because all of this technology is going to create a tremendous amount of data. And I can tell you from the government perspective, the government wants the data. There, I'm sure Emily hears this all the time, how much government wants the data.
Every day.
But they also need to be able to do something with it. And so you need to have the right skill sets available. And so there's this just, there's a transformation that's going to happen with the skills needed. And as the job loss happens, there will be just as many kind of retraining opportunities and the need to switch. And we're seeing it right now, actually, amongst the automakers. We're seeing, and the technology developers, all the companies are buying out each other and establishing partnerships. And quite a few of them are citing that the biggest reason they're doing it is to acquire the talent in the other companies, because there's such a dearth right now for the right talent in this field. So I think we're going to see more and more people getting into the right field. And hopefully, as the community colleges and colleges keep up with what the technology and company requirements are, we'll see that many more jobs created in this space.
Absolutely. And another that's in the been in the news quite a bit is the hacking. You know, there's a fear that my car could be hacked. I know that has come up a number of different times in each of your industries. And Emily, is that something that comes to, do you get lots of questions?
It certainly is something that we have to be very cautious of. Right now, I think Claire probably is smarter than I am on cybersecurity from her engineering background. She might be able to comment on that. But, you know, clearly that that has to be a top priority. And if you think about it, there is an increasing integration within the different stack of technologies that's deployed in this. When you have an automaker manufacturing a vehicle, then you have the self-driving system, then you have the consumer network, all of these are participating at some level in what the operation of that service will be. So there needs to be focus at all of those different levels to ensure that there's security. Do you want to comment at a greater technical depth?
Sure. I think, well, the security is like, would be the same precaution stand for securing your phone, your computer, or your car, or any piece of technology, right? So I think that there's like way to protect ourselves from hacking, and I don't think there's like amazing like ways to do incredible hacking, I would say, or like most of the time if your car get hacked, it's just not gonna start. It's just gonna sit there on the sidewalk and like not start. So it's very inconvenient, but then AAA will like probably like have a solution for that and take your car somewhere to fix it. But like any other piece of technology, there's a way to ensure that the technology is safe. So I think it's just a matter of like working with also like government and cities to make sure to define what is an acceptable behavior and what happens if like you have a problem with a car or with a problem even with a sensor or something like that. Where can you pull on the side? Can the car pull automatically to these areas?
And I think there's also another opportunity there for career technical education to have a lot of folks going into computer science.
Absolutely.
And so that's a whole other career field that is ripe for opportunity. Yep. But Lauren, I know you
correct.
Have, you also were.
Yeah. Well, I don't have too much to say on this. I mean, the one really positive, I think, is that this is very much on the radar of not just the federal government, but every technology developer in this space. This is super important. I mean, it's an issue on all sides. No one wants to see a cybersecurity issue. So, at the federal government level, they actually just put out policy guidance that was really exciting. It covered a lot more than just cybersecurity, but they really became precedent setting by putting out federal guidance around driverless vehicles. This literally just came out about a week ago. And cybersecurity is one thing that's addressed. It's not
in the level of detail. I think that, well, first of all, I don't know that any of us would want to know the level of detail needed to address that, but it does start to address it. And what we're seeing is coalitions form amongst, you know, competing technology developers and automakers that are trying to address this as an industry. So it's very much at the forefront of the AV discussion nationally. So I think that's a positive.
Perfect. And you raised the recent regulations mm-hmm. at the federal level that were promulgated and just discussed. There also has been some legislation in California, and I'm looking towards Lindsay because recently is just a few days ago. Will federal law preempt state law? Is that a discussion that's still being in the works, or what's happening there?
So I think that everyone, from state DOTs to auto manufacturers, we're all really excited to see the federal regulations come out, because up until this point, different states and even down to different jurisdictions were putting in place kind of their own laws and their own way of thinking about how autonomous vehicles could operate on their roadways. And we're starting to inch closer in the long term to a situation where if you're driving your car from California to Nevada, and Nevada has different rules than California, you don't want your car to just stop at the state line because Nevada doesn't allow it. So I think that it's really wonderful to see these federal regulations, because they kind of set the framework for how states should be thinking about putting in place policies. And California's policies very much closely follow the federal guidelines, and I think a lot of states will follow. In fact, part of those guidelines included a model state policy for states to consider, you know, adopting or basing their future policies on, to encourage there to be some sort of kind of level playing field or platform across the United States, so that auto manufacturers and different technology companies didn't have to do something different for every single state or every single jurisdiction. So I know that they, you know, so far, I think people are really happy with them. And I think it kind of remains to be seen how they get rolled out. Right now, they're just kind of guidelines, and they're letting everybody read them. They're going to take comment on them. Same with California. I think the state is hosting a workshop on their proposed policy in a couple of weeks. But I really think that in terms of kind of the state versus federal, that the state will choose to follow the federal guidelines a little more closely than the ones they've developed.
That'd be terrific. I'd hate for the car to stop at the border.
We'll have a lift on the other side of the line.
You'll be right there waiting. I love it. But we've had so many wonderful questions, and the one that keeps coming over and over is, will an autonomous vehicle or truck have a steering wheel? There's about half a dozen questions. Lauren?
As of a week ago, California was requiring that driverless vehicles had a steering wheel. And it was actually very controversial. The California laws required that driverless vehicles had a steering wheel, brakes, and a licensed driver behind the wheel. And really, this policy, which was truly precedent-setting around the country and the world, I mean, this was watched very closely. It was extremely controversial, and it had quite a few industry groups, technology developers come out opposed to it, because it was, in theory, limiting the development of the technology, the testing of the technology, and really not allowing some of the communities that would benefit most greatly from it to reap those benefits. So, but as of now, a week later, federal policy is out. California has changed their guidelines or draft form, but actually eliminated the need for the steering wheel. So, very relevant question.
Any other comments?
Well, certainly, you know, the benefits that I described of bringing down the cost of the service will not come if they're not fully driverless vehicles. So that's really our focus in what would be a transformative business model, is to have a vehicle that's fully capable of that. And in terms of the form factor, the design of the hardware, I mean, that's one of the most exciting things, is the opportunity to reimagine what this experience is like, you know, having it be a hospitality experience, a service that you can have, and maybe even customizations of what that is, depending on who you are, what kind of service you need, or even what experience you want in that moment. So I think that's where you'll see some of the brand differentiation come. I mean, a lot of people have talked about how automakers are going to be commoditized and they're going to lose that brand relationship that they have now with the customer because there's going to be this intermediary of the network, like Lyft, that all of a sudden has the relationship with the customer instead of the car company that's selling someone a car. But I think there are new opportunities for creating consumer value and differentiation in that market, and it's something that we're excited to experiment with moving forward.
We're excited to see it.
We'll get you that wedding lift one of these days.
We also had a number of questions of, should I buy a new car soon or should I wait until the autonomous vehicle is out? So Lauren, why don't you start with that? Okay. And if you could talk about time frames, and I'd like each one of the
first of all, don't buy a car. Don't buy a car. Pretty sure you agree with me, right?
I'm signed on that one.
Yeah.
And don't buy a truck.
So pretty much every automaker and technology developer is promising a fully driverless vehicle in the 2018 to 2022 timeframe, with the exception being Porsche, because they believe that people want to drive their vehicles. So,
I would like to drive a Porsche. I'm not gonna lie. But I've never.
Would
had
you
that
like
chance.
One for your wedding?
So there are countless forecasts out there of when we're going to actually see the proliferation of driverless vehicles. But if I was going to generalize it, it would be about 30 to 40% proliferation in the 2030 timeframe. That's what a lot of forecasts kind of glam around. But you know, should you buy a car now? It's the same question of should cities build parking garages now? I mean, do we need to keep increasing our capacity? Obviously, it's unique to people's situations. What's exciting about today is we're seeing more and more mobility options come out, especially in dense urban areas. And I think we're seeing even more creative solutions in the suburban areas, too. Companies like Lyft and Uber have transformed how we get around cities and have really reduced the need for car ownership. And then you add in all the different mobility as a service options, car sharing, ride sharing, carpooling, and then all the information technology that supports it with, you know, apps that tell you how to leverage a combination of them. So, I mean, the more that we can reduce car ownership now, and the more we can encourage people to really do that ride sharing behavior today, it's going to be that much more important when we have driverless vehicles out on the roadways. And, you know, in theory, selfishly, we all want to have a driverless vehicle that just takes us wherever we want to go. It's like having a personal chauffeur. I always use the example of an elliptical car. And the elliptical trainer in the back of my vehicle with a coffee maker and a TV and a desk. And I'm
sign
like,
me up.
Why would I ever go in a shared vehicle when I can have my own personal like hotel back there? But that's really a kind of scary thing for our society if every single person had a vehicle like that. So I think it's important that we wrap our heads around this shared vehicle behavior, just because we don't want to be in a society of just parking lots everywhere we go.
I'm going to take a little bit of an opposite view from Lauren. I love being on stage with Lauren because we rarely agree.
next to each other,
but we're still
like
good friends. And I would say I agree. I think most of the major car companies have said they could put an autonomous vehicle for sale in the next 5 years. What I think we have to think about is that the regulations and the policy that govern you being able to use that are not going to move that quickly. As much as we want to see them tomorrow, as much as we know there are tremendous benefits, government does not move as fast as the private sector. And I don't foresee that changing anytime in the next year or two in order for everything to catch up and you be able to buy an autonomous vehicle and roll it out on the street. So if you're not able to take advantage of a shared network, if you live in a county that has rural areas or you're car dependent, my advice is buy a new car because they are getting smarter and smarter every year. As Claire mentioned, you know, your car can now do things for you. It can autonomously forward brake. It can park itself. It can help keep you in your lane. Some of the newer cars can even tell if you're starting to get sleepy and alert you that you need to pull over. We're putting the pieces in place to get those cars to become autonomous, and there are cars being manufactured that could drive themselves, but unfortunately I don't think the regulations are ready to let you flip the switch in the next couple years.
We have so many more questions, so clearly we need to have a series of panels on autonomous vehicles, including cars and trucks. We are at the point where we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question. If we do a quick round, if you had advice to give to our presidential candidates, what would you want them to say about autonomous vehicles? One sentence or less. You want to start, Lauren, sure. And then we'll work to sure. Lindsay and Claire and Emily. Yeah.
I think it's super exciting what technology is presenting to us today, and I think it's only going to grow with the ideas and the potential, but it's also very important for government at all levels to be involved, so we need to have enabling funding, policy, supportive regulations, nothing that slows it down, but yet still maintains the safety of our traveling public.
And I would say fund transportation to its fullest in all forms, including autonomous vehicle research, because that's the way we're going to get to this scenario where you're able to ride in an autonomous vehicle, is if there's kind of a collective effort and enough research for everyone to feel that it's safe.
Claire, quick.
So autonomous vehicles are coming. It's going to be a new class of vehicle and transportation is not going to be like anything that we know right now. It's going to change everything. And private sector cannot do it alone. It needs to be like well thought from like everybody on board, private and governments.
I would say the most important thing that government can do is focus on performance-based policies, because it's very hard to prescribe the how, the mechanism of something that you don't understand and haven't experienced before. I think the best thing they can do is to let the private sector innovate on the way to get to the desired policy outcomes of safety, of mobility, of environmental performance, and in doing that, make sure that their objectives are met while allowing innovation to flourish.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to make sure the candidates see this end of the clip so that they get the advice. Well, I'd like to thank our panelists. Emily, thank you very much. Director of Transportation Policy at Lyft. Claire, been a terrific co-founder, director of software engineering at Otto. Lauren, manager of transportation, WSP, Parsons Brinkerhoff. Mm-hmm. And Lindsay, director of external affairs for Contra Costa. Thank you for all for your participation. I would like to thank the audience for your participation, for the Commonwealth Club for hosting in this evening. You've been a terrific audience, and good night.